small thing done because my appetite demands it. But you've laid waste the hopes of generations. You've destroyed the fruit of great men's trees. And still you claim you would give yourself to save her little soul.
This eloquence startled Gentle, but its essence startled him more. Where had the creature plucked these conceits from, that it could so easily spill them now? They were inventions, of course, but they confounded him nevertheless, and his thoughts strayed from his present jeopardy for a vital moment. The creature saw him drop his guard and acted on the instant, though it was no more than 2 yards from him. He heard the sliver of silence between the light and its report, a void confirming how foul a savior he was. Death was on its way towards the child before his warning cry was even in his throat. He turned to see his angel standing in the alleyway some distance from him. She had either turned in anticipation or had been listening to the Nullianak's speech, because she stood full face to the blow coming at her. Still, time ran slow, and Gentle had several aching moments in which to see how her eyes were fixed upon him, her tears all dried, her gaze unblinking. Time, too, for that warning shout, in acknowledgement of which she closed her eyes, her face becoming a blank upon which he could inscribe any accusation his guilt wished to contrive. Then the Nullianak's blow was upon her. The force struck her body at speed, but it didn't break her flesh, and for an instant he dared hope she had found some defence against it. But its hurt was more insidious than a bullet or a blow, its light spreading from the point of impact up to her face, where it entered by every means it could, and down to where its dispatcher's fingers had already pried. He let out another shout, this time of revulsion, and turned back on the Nullianak, raising the gun its words had made him so forgetful of, and firing at its heart. It fell back against the wall, its arms slack at its side, the space between its skulls still issuing its lethal light. Then he looked back at Hazar to see that it had eaten her away from the inside, and that she was flowing back along the line of her destroyer's gaze into the chamber from which the stroke had been delivered. Even as he watched, her face collapsed, and her limbs, never substantial, decayed and went the same way. Before she was entirely consumed, however, the harm Gentle's bullet had done the Nullianak took its toll. The stream of power fractured and failed. When it did, darkness descended, and for a time Gentle couldn't even see the creature's body. Then the bombardment on the hill began afresh, its blaze brief but bright enough to show him the Nullianak's corpse, lying in the dirt where it had squatted. He watched it, expecting some final act of retaliation, but none came. The light died and left Gentle to retreat along the alleyway, weighed down not only by his failure to save Hazar's life, but by his lack of comprehension of what had just happened. In plain terms, a child in his care had been slaughtered by her molester, and he'd failed to prevent that slaughter. But he'd been wandering in the dominions too long to be content with simple assessments. There was more here than stymied lust and sudden death. Words had been uttered more appropriate to pulpit than gutter. Hadn't he himself called Hazar his angel? Hadn't he seen her grow seraphic at the end, knowing she was about to die and accepting that fate? And hadn't he in his turn been dubbed a deficient saviour, and proved that accusation true by failing to deliver her? These were high-flown words, but he badly needed to believe them apt, not so that he could indulge messianic fantasies, but so that the grief welling in him might be softened by the hope that there was a higher purpose here, which in the fullness of time he'd come to know and understand. A burst of fire threw light down the alleyway, and Gentle's shadow fell across something twitching in the filth. It took him a moment to comprehend what he was seeing, but when he did, he loosed a shout. Hazar had not quite gone. Small scraps of her skin and sinew, dropped when the Nullianak's claim upon her was cut short, moved here in the rot. None were recognizable. Indeed, had they not been moving in the folds of her bloodied clothes, he'd not even have known them as her flesh. He reached down to touch them, tears stinging his eyes, but before his fingers could make contact, what little life the scraps had owned went out. He rose, raging, rose in horror at the filth beneath his feet, and the dead, empty houses that channeled it, and in disgust at himself for surviving when his angel had not. Turning his gaze on the nearest wall, he drew breath and put not one hand but two against his lips, intending to do what little he could to bury these remains. But rage and revulsion were fueling his pneuma, and when it went from him it brought down not one wall but several, passing through the teetering houses like a bullet through a pack of cards. Shards of pulverized stone flew as the houses toppled, the collapse of one initiating the fall of the next, the dust cloud growing in scale as each house added to its sum. He started up the alleyway in pursuit of the pneuma, fearing that his disgust had given it more purpose than he'd intended. It was heading towards Licorice Street, where the crowds were still milling, oblivious to its approach. They were not wandering that street innocent of its corruption, of course, but neither did their presence there deserve death. He wished he could draw the breath as he exhaled it, call the pneuma back into himself, but it had its head, and all he could do was run after it as it brought down house after house, hoping it would spend its power before it reached the crowd. He could see the lights of Licorice Street through the hail of demolition. He picked up his pace to try and outrun the pneuma, and was a little ahead of it when he set eyes on the throng itself, thicker than ever. Some had interrupted their window shopping to watch the spectacle of destruction. He saw their gawking faces, their little smiles, their shaking heads, saw they didn't comprehend for an instant what was coming their way. Knowing any attempt to warn them verbally would be lost in the furor, he raced to the end of the alleyway and flung himself into their midst, intending to scatter them. But his antics only drew a larger audience, who were in turn intrigued by the alleyway's capitulation. One or two had grasped their jeopardy now, their expressions of curiosity become looks of fear. Finally, too late, their unease spread to the rest, and a general retreat began. The pneuma was too quick, however. It broke through the last of the walls in a devastating shower of rock shards and splinters, striking the crowd at its densest place. Had Hapexamendios, in a fit of cleansing ire, delivered a judgment on Licorice Street, he could scarcely have scarred it better. What had seconds before been a crowd of puzzled sightseers was blood and bone in a heartbeat. Though he stood in the midst of this devastation, Gentle remained unharmed. He was able to watch his terrible weapon at work, its power apparently undecayed despite the fact that it had demolished a string of houses. Nor, having cut a swath through the crowd, was it following the trajectory set at his lips. It had found flesh and clearly intended to busy itself in the midst of living stuff until there was none left to undo. He was appalled at the prospect. This hadn't been his intention, or anything like it. There seemed to be only one option available to him, and that he instantly took. He stood in the pneuma's path. He'd used the power in his lungs many times now, first against the Nullianak's brother in Vanayev, then twice in the mountains, and finally on the island when they were making their escape from Vigor Nashap's asylum. But in all that time he'd only had the vaguest impression of its appearance. Was it like a fire-breather's belch? Or like a bullet made of will and air, nearly invisible until it did its deed. Perhaps it had been the latter once, but now, as he set himself in its path, he saw that it had gathered dust and blood along its route, and from those essential elements it had made itself a likeness of its maker. It was his face that was coming at him, albeit roughly sculpted, his brow, his eyes, his open mouth, expelling the very breath it had begun with. It didn't slow as it approached its maker, but struck Gentle's chest the way it had struck so many before him. He felt the blow, but was not felled by it. Instead, the power, knowing its source, discharged itself through his system, running to his fingertips and coursing across his scalp. Its shock was come and gone in a moment, and he was left standing in the middle of the devastation with his arms spread wide and the dust falling around him. Silence followed. Distantly he could hear the wounded sobbing and half-demolished walls going to rubble, but he was encircled by a hush that was almost reverential. Somebody dropped to his knees nearby, to tend, he thought, to one of the wounded. Then he heard the hallelujahs the man was uttering and saw his hands reaching up towards him. Another of the crowd followed suit. and then another, as though this scene of their deliverance was a sign they'd been waiting for, and a long-suppressed flood of devotion was breaking from each of their hearts. Sickened, Gentle turned his gaze away from their grateful faces up the dusty length of Licorice Street. He had only one ambition now, to find Pi and take comfort from this insanity in the Mistiff's arms. He broke from his ring of devotees and started up the street, ignoring their clinging hands and cries of adoration. He wanted to berate them for their naivety, but what good would that do? Any pronouncement he made now, however self-deprecatory, would probably be taken as the jotting for some gospel. Instead, he kept his silence and picked his way over the stones and corpses, his head down. The hosannas followed him, but he didn't once acknowledge them, knowing even as he went that his reluctance might seem like divine humility, but unable to escape the trap circumstance had set. The wasteland at the head of the street was as daunting as ever, but he started across it not caring what fires might come. Its terrors were nothing beside the memory of Hussar's scrap, twitching in the muck, or the hallelujahs he could still hear behind him, raised in ignorance of the fact that he, the saviour of Licorice Street, was also its destroyer, but no less tempting for that. Chapter 34. 1. Every trace of the joy that the vast halls of the Cianculli had once seen, no clowns or ponies, but circuses such as any showman in the Fifth would have wept to own, had gone. The echoing halls had become places of mourning and of judgment. Today the accused was the Mistiff Pi O'Parr, its accuser one of the few lawyers in his order ex the Autarch's purges had left alive, an asthmatic and pinched individual called Thess Re Ott. He had an audience of two for his prosecution, Pi O'Parr and the judge. But he delivered his litany of crimes as if the hall were full to the rafters. The Mistiff was guilty enough to warrant a dozen executions, he said. It was at very least a traitor and coward, but probably also an informant and a spy. Worse, perhaps, it had abandoned this dominion for another without the consent of its family or its teachers, denying its people the benefit of its rarity. Had it forgotten, in its arrogance, that its condition was sacred, and that to prostitute itself in another world, the Fifth, of all places, a mire of unmiraculous souls, was not only a sin upon itself, but upon its species? It had gone from this place clean and dared to return debauched and corrupted, bringing a creature of the Fifth with it, and then freely confessing that said creature was its husband. Pi had expected to be met with some recriminations upon return. The memories of Yerhatemic were long, and they clung strongly to tradition as the only contact they had with the First Dominion. But the vehemence of this catalogue was still astonishing. The judge, Culus Siu Erai, was a woman of great age, but diminished physique, who sat bundled in robes as colourless as her skin, listening to the litany of accusations without once looking at either accuser or accused. When Thess Re Ott had finished, she offered the Mistiff the chance to defend itself, and it did what it could. "I admit I've made many errors," Pi said, "not least leaving my family, and my people were my family, without telling them where I was going or why. But the simple fact is, I didn't know. I fully intended to return after maybe a year or so. I thought it'd be fine to have travellers' tales to tell. Now, when I finally return, I find there's nobody to tell them to." "What possessed you to go into the Fifth?" Culus asked. "Another error," Pi said. "I went to Padashokwa and I met a theurgist there who said he could take me over to the Fifth. Just for a jaunt. We'd be back in a day," he said. "A day." I thought this was a fine idea. I'd come home having walked in the Fifth Dominion. So I paid him.
"In what currency?"
said Thess Re Ott.
"Cash, and some little favours. I didn't prostitute myself, if that's what you're suggesting. If I had, maybe he'd have kept his promises. Instead, his ritual delivered me into the In Ovo."
"And how long were you there?"
Culus Siu Erai inquired.
"I don't know," the Mistiff replied. The suffering there seemed endless and unendurable, but it was perhaps only days.
Thess Re Ot snorted at this.
Its sufferings were of its own making, ma'am. Are they strictly relevant?
Probably not, Kilda Suerai conceded. But you were claimed out of the Inovo by a maestro of the fifth. Am I right?
Yes, ma'am. His name was Satori. He was the fifth's representative in the synod preparing for the reconciliation.
And you served him?
I did.
In what capacity?
In any way he chose to request. I was his familiar.
Thess Re Ot made a sound of disgust. His response was not feigned, Pi thought. He was genuinely appalled at the thought of one of his people, especially a creature so blessed as a mischief, serving the will of a Homo sapiens.
Was Sartori, in your estimation, a good man?
Culus asked Pi.
He was the usual paradox. Compassion when it was least expected, cruelty the same. He had an extraordinary ego, but then I don't believe he could have carried the responsibility of the reconciliation without one.
Was he cruel to you?
Culus inquired.
Ma'am? Do you not understand the question?
Yes, but not its relevance.
Culus growled with displeasure.
This court may be much reduced in pomp and ceremony, she said, and its officers a little withered, but the authority of both remains undiminished. Do you understand me, Mischief? When I ask a question, I expect it answered, promptly and truthfully.
Pi murmured apologies.
So, said Culus, I will repeat the question. Was Sartori cruel to you?
Sometimes, Pi replied.
And yet, when the reconciliation failed, you didn't forsake his company and return to this dominion?
He'd summoned me out of the Inovo. He'd bound me to him. I had no jurisdiction.
Unlikely,
Thess Re Ot remarked.
Are you asking us to believe?
Did I hear you ask permission to question the accused again?
Culus snapped.
No, ma'am.
Do you request such permission?
Yes, ma'am.
Denied,
Culus replied and turned her eye back upon Pi.
I think you learned a great deal in the Fifth Dominion, Mischief, she said. And you're the worst for it. You're arrogant. You're sly, and you're probably just as cruel as your maestro. But I don't believe you're a spy. You're something worse than that. You're a fool. You turned your back on people who loved you and let yourself be enslaved by a man responsible for the deaths of a great many fine souls across the Imagica. I can tell you've got something to say, Thess Re Ot. Spit it out before I give judgment.
Only that the Mischief isn't here simply charged with spying, ma'am. In denying its people the benefits of its birthright, it committed a grievous crime against us.
I don't doubt that, Culus said, and it frankly sickens me to look on something so tainted that once had perfectibility within its grasp. But may I remind you, Thess Re Ot, how few we are? The tribe is diminished to almost nothing, and this Mischief, whose breed was always rare, is the last of its line.
The last? Said Pi.
Yes, the last,
Culus replied, her voice trembling as it rose.
While you were at play in the Fifth Dominion, our people have been systematically decimated. There are now fewer than 50 souls here in the city. The rest are either dead or scattered. Your own line is destroyed, Pi Opa. Every last one of your clan is murdered or dead of grief.
The Mischief covered its face with its hands, and Culus didn't spare it the rest of her report.
Two other Mischiefs survived the purges, she went on, until just a year ago. One was murdered here in the Chiancula while it was healing a child. The other went into the desert. The Dearth are there, at the edge of the First, and the Autarch's troops don't like to go so near to the Erasure. But they caught up with it before it reached the tents. They brought its body back and hung it on the gates.
She stepped down from her chair and approached Pi, who was sobbing now.
So, you see, it may be that you did the right thing for the wrong reasons. If you'd stayed, you'd be dead by now. Mom, I protest,
Thesrae Ott said.
What would you prefer I did?
Culus said.
Add this foolish creature's blood to the sea already spilt? No, better we try and turn its taint to our advantage.
Pi looked up, puzzled.
Perhaps we've been too pure, too predictable. Our stratagems foreseen, our plots easily uncovered. But you're from another world, Mistiff, and maybe that makes you potent.
She paused for breath. Then she said,
This is my judgment. Take whomsoever you can find among our number, and use your tainted ways to murder our enemy. If none will go with you, go alone, but don't return here, Mistiff, while the Autarch is still breathing.
Thesrae Ott let out a laugh that rang around the chamber.
Perfect,
he said.
Perfect! I'm glad my judgment amuses you,
Culus replied.
Remove yourself, Thesrae Ott.
He made to protest, but she brought forth such a shout he flinched as if struck.
I said, remove yourself!
The laughter fell from his face. He made a small formal bow, murmuring some chilly words of parting as he did so, and left the chamber. She watched him go.
We have all become cruel, she said. You in your way, us in ours.
She looked back at Pi O'Pa.
Do you know why he laughed, Mistiff?
Because he thinks your judgment is execution by another name?
Yes, that's precisely what he thinks. And who knows? Perhaps that's what it is. But this may be the last night of the Dominion. And last things have power tonight they never had before.
And I'm a last thing.
Yes, you are.
The Mistiff nodded.
I understand, it said, and it seems just. Good, she said.
Though the trial was over, neither moved.
You have a question?
Culus asked.
Yes, I do. Better ask it now.
Do you know if a shaman called Aray Kagai is still alive? Culus made a little smile.
I wondered when you'd get to him, she said. He was one of the survivors of the reconciliation, wasn't he?
Yes.
I didn't know him that well, but I heard him speak of you. He held on to life long after most people would have given up, because he said you'd come back eventually. He didn't realize you were bound to your maestro, of course.
She said all this disingenuously, but there was a penetrating look in her rheumy eyes throughout.
Why didn't you come back, Mistiff? She said. And don't spin me some story about jurisdiction. You could have slipped your bondage if you'd put your mind to it, especially in the confusion after the failure of the reconciliation. But you didn't. You chose to stay with your wretched Sartori, even though members of your own tribe had been victims of his ineptitude.
He was a broken man, and I was more than his familiar. I was his friend. How could I leave him?
That's not all,
Culus said. She'd been a judge too long to let such simplifications pass unchallenged.
What else, Mistiff? This is the night of last things, remember? Tell it now, or run the risk of not telling it at all.
Very well, said Pi. I always nurtured the hope that there would be another attempt at reconciliation, and I wasn't the only one who nurtured such a hope.
Arekagai indulged it too, huh?
Yes, he did.
So that's why he kept your name alive. And himself, too, waiting for you to come back.
She shook her head.
Why do you wallow in these fantasies? There'll be no reconciliation. If anything, it'll be the other way about. The Imagicar'll come apart at the seams, and every dominion will be sealed up in its own little misery.
That's a grim vision.
It's an honest one, and a rational one. There are still people in every dominion willing to try again. They've waited 200 years, and they're not going to let go of their hope now. Arekagai let go,
Kula said.
He died 2 years ago.
I was prepared for that eventuality, Pai said. He was old when I knew him last.
If it's any comfort, your name was on his lips at the very end. He never gave up believing.
There are others who can perform the ceremonies in his place.
I was right, Kula said. You are a fool, Mistiff.
She started towards the door.
Do you do this in memory of your maestro?
Pai went with her, opening the door and stepping out into a twilight sharp with smoke.
Why would I do that?
Pai said.
Because you loved him,
Kulis said, her gaze accusatory.
And that's the real reason why you never came back here. You loved him more than your own people.
Perhaps that's true, Pai said. But why would I do anything in memory of the living?
The living?
The Mistiff smiled, bowing to its judge as it retreated from the light at the door, fading into the gloom like a phantom.
I told you Satori was a broken man, not a dead one,
it said as it went.
The dream is still alive, Kulus Suerai, and so is my maestro.
2. Quasar was waiting behind the veils when Sadox came in. The windows were open, and within the warm dusk came a din aphrodisiacal to a soldier-like Sadox. He peered at the veils, trying to make out the figure behind them. Was she naked? It seemed so.
I have an apology to make, she said to him.
There's no need.
There's every need. You were doing your duty, watching me.
She paused. When she spoke again, her voice was sinuous.
I like to be watched, Sadox.
He murmured, You do?
Certainly, as long as my audience is appreciative.
I'm appreciative, he said, surreptitiously dropping his cigarette and grinding it out beneath the heel of his boot.
Then why don't you close the door, she said to him, in case we get noisy. Maybe you should tell the guards to go and get drunk.
He did so. When he returned to the veils, he saw that she was kneeling up on the bed, her hand between her legs, and, yes, she was naked. When she moved, the veils moved with her, some of them sticking momentarily to the oiled gloss of her skin. He could see how her breasts rode up as she raised her arms, inviting his kisses there. He put his hand out to part the veils, but they were too abundant, and he could find no break in them, so he simply pressed on towards her, half blinded by their luxury. Her hand went down once more between her legs, and he couldn't conceal a moan of anticipation at the thought of replacing it with his own. There was swelling in her fingers, he thought. Some device she'd been pleasuring herself with, most likely anticipating his arrival, easing herself open to accommodate his every inch. Thoughtful, pliant thing that she was even handing it to him now, as though in confession of her little sin, thinking perhaps that he'd want to feel its warmth and wetness. She pushed it through the veils towards him as he in turn pressed towards her, murmuring as he went a few promises that ladies like to hear. Between those promises he caught the sound of tearing fabric, and assuming that she was clawing her way through the veils in her hunger to reach him, began to do the same himself until he felt a sharp pain in his belly. He looked down through the layers that clung about his face and saw a stain spreading through the weave. He let out a cry and started to disentangle himself, catching sight of her pleasuring device buried deep in him as he wrestled to be out of her way. She withdrew the blade only to plunge it into him a second time, and a third, leaving it in his heart as he fell backwards, his fingers dragging the veils down with him. Standing at one of the upper windows of Peckable's house, watching the fires that raged in every direction, Jude shuddered, and looking down at her hands, saw them glistening, wet with blood. The vision lasted only the briefest time, but she had no doubt of what she'd seen, nor what it signified. Quasar had committed the crime she'd been plotting.
"It's quite a sight, isn't it?"
she heard Dowd say, and turned to look at him, momentarily disoriented. Had he seen the blood, too? No, he was talking about the fires.
"Yes, it is," she said.
He came to join her at the glass, which rattled with each fusillade.
"The Peckables are almost ready to leave. I suggest we do the same. I'm feeling much renewed."
He had indeed healed with astonishing speed. The wounds on his face were barely visible now.
"Where will we go?" she said.
"Around the other side of the city," he said, "to where I first trod the boards. According to Peckable, the theatre is still standing. The Ipse, it's called. Built by Pluthero Quexos himself. I'd like to see it again."
"You want to be a tourist on a night like this?"
"The theatre may not be standing tomorrow. In fact, the whole of his Ordrex could be in ruins by daybreak. I thought you were the one who was so hungry to see it."
"If it's a sentimental visit," she said, "maybe you should go alone."
"Why? Have you got some other agenda?"
he asked her.
"You have, haven't you?"
"How could I have?" she protested lightly. "I've never set foot here before."
He studied her, his face all suspicion.
"But you always wanted to come here, didn't you? Right from the start. Godolphin used to wonder where you got the obsession from. Now I'm wondering the same."
He followed her gaze through the window.
"What's out there, Judith?"
"You can see for yourself," she replied. "We'll probably get killed before we reach the top of the street."
"No," he said, "not us. We're blessed."
"Are we?"
"We're the same, remember. Perfect partners."
"I remember," she replied.
10 minutes, then we'll go."
"I'll be ready."
She heard the door close behind her, then looked down at her hands again. All trace of the vision had faded. She glanced back towards the door to be certain that Dowd had gone, then put her hands to the glass and closed her eyes. She had 10 minutes to find the woman who shared her face, 10 minutes before she and Dowd were out in the tumult of the streets and all hope of contact would be dashed.
"Quasar," she murmured.
She felt the glass vibrate against her palms and heard the din of the dying across the roofs. She said her double's name a second time, turning her thoughts to the towers that would have been visible from this very window, if the air between hadn't been so thick with smoke. The image of that smoke filled her head, though she hadn't consciously conjured it, and she felt her thoughts rise in its clouds, wafted on the heat of destruction. It was difficult for Quasar to find something discreet to wear among the armaments she'd acquired for their immodesty, but by tearing all the decoration from one of her simpler robes, she had achieved something like seamliness. Now she left her chambers and prepared for her final journey through the palace. She had already plotted her route once she was out of the gates, back down to the harbour, where she'd first seen the Man of Sorrows standing on the roof. If he wasn't there, she would find somebody who knew his whereabouts. He hadn't come into his Ordrex simply to disappear again. He would leave trails for his acolytes to follow, and trials, no doubt, for them to endure, proving in their endurance how much they desired to come into his presence. But first, she had to get out of the palace, and to do so she took corridors and stairways that had not been used in decades, familiar only to her, the Autarch, and the masons who'd laid these cold stones, cold themselves now. Only maestros and their mistresses preserved their youth, and doing so was no longer the bliss it had been. She would have liked the years to show on her face when she knelt before the Nazarene, so that he would know that she'd suffered, and that she deserved his forgiveness. But she would have to trust that. He would see through the veil of her perfection to the pain beneath. Her feet were bare, and the chill rose through her soles so that by the time she reached the humid air outside, her teeth were chattering. She halted for a moment to orient herself in the maze of courtyards that surrounded the palace, and as she turned her thoughts from the practical to the abstract, she met another thought, waiting at the back of her skull for just such a turn. She didn't doubt its source for a moment. The angel that Sadox had driven from her chamber that afternoon had waited at the threshold all this time, knowing she would come at last, seeking guidance. Tears started to her eyes when she realized she'd not been forsaken. The Son of David knew her agony and sent this messenger to whisper in her head. "Ipse," it said. "Ipse." She knew what the word meant. She'd patronized the Ipse many times, masked, as were all the women of the Haute Monde, when visiting places of moral dubiety. She'd seen all the works of Quexos performed there, and translations of Flotter, even on occasions Kopasovi's farces, crude as they were. That the Man of Sorrows should have chosen such a place was certainly strange, but who was she to question his purposes?
"I hear," she said aloud.
Even before the voice in her had faded, she was making her way through the courtyards to the gate by which she would be delivered most readily into the Deliquium Kesperet, where Pleuthro Quexos had built his shrine to artifice, soon to be reconsecrated in the name of truth. Jude took her hands from the window and opened her eyes. There had been none of the clarity she'd experienced when asleep in this contact. In truth, she was not even certain she'd made it. But there was no time left to try again. Dowd was calling her, and so were the streets of Isorderex, blazing though they were. She'd seen blood spilt from her place by the window, numerous assaults and beatings, troop charges and retreats, civilians warring in rabid packs and others marching in brigades, armed and ordered. In such a chaos of factions, she had no way of judging the legitimacy of any cause, nor, in truth, did she much care. Her mission was seek out her sister in this maelstrom, and hope that she in her turn was seeking out Jude. Quasar would be disappointed, of course, if and when they finally met. Jude was not the messenger of the Lord she was hurrying to find. But then lords divine or secular were not the redeemers and salvers of the world legend made them out to be. They were spoilers. They were destroyers. The evidence of that was out there, in the very streets Jude was about to tread, and if she could only make Quasar share and understand that vision, perhaps the promise of sisterhood would not be so unwelcome a gift to bring to this meeting, which she could not help but think of as a reunion. Chapter 35 1. Demanding directions as he went, usually from wounded men, Gentle took several hours to get from the Hosannas of Licorice Street to the Mistiff's Kesperet, during which period the city's decline into chaos quickened, so that he went half expecting that the streets of straight houses and blossom-clad trees would be ashes and rubble by the time he arrived. But when he finally came to the city within a city, he found it untouched by looters or demolishers, either because they knew there was little of worth to them here or, more likely, because the lingering superstition about a people who'd once occupied the Unbeheld's dominion kept them from doing their worst. Entering, he went first to the Chiancula, prepared to do whatever was necessary, threaten, beg, cajole, in order to be returned into the Mistiff's company. The Chiancula and all the adjacent buildings were deserted, however, so he began a systematic search of the streets. They, like the Chiancula, were empty, and as his desperation grew, his discretion fled until he was shouting Pi's name to the empty streets like a midnight drunkard. Eventually, these tactics earned him a response. One of the quartet who'd appeared to offer such chilly welcome when he'd first come here appeared, the mustached young man. His robes were not held between his teeth this time, and when he spoke, he deigned to do so in English. But the lethal ribbon still fluttered in his hands, its threat undisguised.
"You came back," he said.
"Where's Pi?"
"Where's the girl, child?"
"Dead. Where's Pi?"
"You seem different."
"I am. Where's Pi?"
"Not here."
"Where then?"
"The Mistiff's gone up to the palace," the man replied.
"Why?"
"That was the judgment upon it."
"Just to go?" Gentle said.
taking a step towards the man. There must have been more to it than that. Though the silk sword protected the man, Gentle came with a burden of power that beggared his own, and sensing this he answered less obliquely.
"The judgment was that it kill the Ortak," he said.
"So it's been sent up there alone?"
"No, it took some of our tribe with it and left a few of us to guard the Kesprit."
"How long ago since they went?"
"Not very long. But you won't get into the palace, neither will they. It's suicide."
Gentle didn't linger to argue but headed back towards the entrance, leaving the man to guard the blossoms and the empty streets. As he approached the gate, however, he saw that two individuals, a man and a woman, had just entered and were looking his way. Both were naked from the waist up, their throats painted with the blue triple stripe he remembered from the siege at the harbour, marking them as members of the Dearth. At his approach, both acknowledged him by putting palm to palm and inclining their heads. The woman was half as big again as her companion, her body a glorious machine, her head, shaved but for a ponytail, set on a neck wider than her cranium, and like her arms and belly, so elaborately muscled the merest twitch was a spectacle.
"I said he'd be here," she told the world.
"I don't know what you want," he said, "but I can't supply it."
"You are John Fury Zacharias?"
"Yes."
"Called Gentle?"
"Yes, but—"
"Then you have to come. Please, Father Athanasius sent us to find you. We heard what happened on Licorice Street, and we knew it had to be you. I'm Nicke Tomas,"
the woman said.
"This is Flockus Dardo. We've been waiting for you since Esterbrook arrived."
"Esterbrook?" said Gentle. There was a man he hadn't given a thought to in many a month. "How do you know him?"
"We found him in the street. We thought he was the one, but he wasn't. He knew nothing."
"And you think I do?" Gentle said, exasperated. "Let me tell you, I know fuck all. I don't know who you think I am, but I'm not your man."
"That's what Father Athanasius said. He said you were in ignorance."
"Well, he was right."
"But you married the Mischief."
"So what?" said Gentle. "I love it, and I don't care who knows it."
"We realize that,"
Nicke Tomas said, as though nothing could have been plainer.
"That's how we tracked you."
"We knew it would come here," Flockus said, "and wherever it had gone, you would be."
"It isn't here," Gentle said. "It's up in the palace."
"In the palace?"
said Nicke Tomas, turning her gaze up towards the lowering walls.
"And you intend to follow it?"
"Yes."
"Then I'll come with you," she said. "Mr. Dado, go back to Athanasius. Tell him who we found and where we've gone."
"I don't want company," Gentle said. "I don't even trust myself."
"How will you get into the palace without someone at your side?" Nicke Tomas said. "I know the gates. I know the courtyards."
Gentle turned the options over in his head. Part of him wanted to go as a rogue, carrying the chaos he'd brought to Licorice Street as his emblem. But his ignorance of palace geography could indeed slow him, and minutes might make the difference between finding the Mischief alive or dead. He nodded his consent, and the parties divided at the gate. Flockus Dado back to Father Athanasius, Gentle and Nicke Tomas up towards the Ortak's fortress. The only subject he broached as they travelled was that of Esterbrook. "How was he?" Gentle asked. "Still crazy?"
"He was almost dead when we found him," Nicke Tomas said. "His brother left him here for dead, but we took him to our tents on the Erasure, and we healed him there, or more properly, his being there healed him."
"You did all this thinking he was me?"
"We knew that somebody was going to come from the Fifth to begin the reconciliation again, and of course we knew it had to be soon. We just didn't know what he looked like."
"Well, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but that's twice you've got it wrong. I'm no more your man than Esterbrook."
"Why did you come here, then?" she said.
That was an inquiry that deserved a serious reply, if not for her sake, then for his own. "There were questions I wanted answered, but I couldn't answer on Earth," he said. "A friend of mine died, very young. A woman I knew was almost murdered."
"Judith?"
"Yes, Judith."
"We've talked about her a great deal," Nicke Tomas said. "Esterbrook was obsessed with her."
"Is he still?"
"I haven't spoken to him for a long time, but you know he was trying to bring her to Isorderix when his brother intervened."
"Did she come?"
"Apparently not," Nicke Tomas said. but Athanasius believes she will eventually. He says she's part of the story of the reconciliation.
How does he work that out?
From Esterbrook's obsession with her, I suppose. The way he talked about her, it was though she was something holy, and Athanasius loves holy women.
Let me tell you, I know Judith very well, and she's no virgin.
There are other kinds of sanctity among our sex, Nicodemus replied, a little testily.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean any offence. But if there's one thing Jude's always hated, it's being put on a pedestal.
Then maybe it's not the idol we should be studying, but the worshipper. Athanasius says obsession is fire to our fortress.
What does that mean?
That we have to burn down the walls around us, but it takes a very bright flame to do so.
An obsession, in other words.
That's one such flame, yes.
Why would we want to burn down these walls in the first place? Don't they protect us?
Because if we don't, we die inside, kissing our own reflections.
Nicodemus said, the reply too well turned to be improvised. Athanasius again, Gentle said.
No, said Nicodemus, an aunt of mine. She's been locked up in the bastion for years, but in here, Nicodemus pointed to her temple, she's free.
And what about the autarch? Gentle said, turning his gaze up towards the fortress.
What about him?
Is he up there, kissing his reflection?
Who knows? Maybe he's been dead for years and the state's running itself.
Do you seriously believe that?
Nicodemus shook her head.
No, he's alive behind his walls.
What's he keeping out, I wonder?
Who knows? Whatever he's afraid of, I don't think it breathes the same air that we do.
Before they left, the rubble-strewn thoroughfares of the Kesperate called Hitahite, which lay between the gates of the Urhatamic Kesperate and the wide Roman streets of Isordrex's bureaucratic district, Nicodemus dug around in the ruins of a garret for some means of disguise. She found a collection of filthy garments which she insisted Gentle don, then found some equally disgusting for herself. Their faces and physiques had to be concealed, she explained, so that they could mingle freely with the wretched they'd find gathered at the gates. Then they headed on, their climb bringing them into streets lined with buildings of classical severity and scale, as yet unscorched by the torches that were being passed from hand to hand, roof to roof, in the Kesperates below. They would not remain pristine much longer, Nicodemus predicted. When the rebels' fire reached these edifices, the taxation courts and the bureaus of justice, it would leave no pillar unblackened. But for now the travellers moved between monoliths as quiet as mausoleums. On the other side, the reason for their donning of stinking and louse-ridden clothes became apparent. Nicodemus had brought them not to one of the great gates of the palace, but to a minor opening, around which a group dressed in motley indistinguishable from their own was gathered. Some of them carried candles. By their fitful light, Gentle could see that there was not a single body that was whole among them.
"Are they waiting to get in?" he asked his guide.
"No, this is the gate of St. Cries and St. Evendown. Have you not heard of them in the Fifth? I thought that's where they were martyred."
"Very possibly.
They appear everywhere in Isordrex. Nursery rhymes, puppet plays."
"So what happens here? Do the saints make personal appearances?"
"After a fashion."
"And what are these people hoping for?" Gentle asked, casting a glance among the wretched assembly. "Healing?" They were certainly in dire need of such miracles. Crippled and diseased, suppurating and broken, some of them looked so weak they'd not make it till morning.
"No," Nicodemus replied, "they're here for sustenance. I only hope the saints aren't too distracted by the revolution to put in an appearance."
She'd no sooner spoken than the sound of an engine chugging into life on the far side of the gates pitched the crowd into frenzy. Crutches became weapons and diseased spittle flew as the invalids fought for a place close to the bounty they knew was imminent. Nicodemus pushed Gentle forward into the brawl, where he was obliged to fight, though he felt ashamed to do so, or else have his limbs torn from their sockets by those who had fewer than he. Head down, arms flailing, he dug his way forward as the gates began to open. What appeared on the other side drew gasps of devotion from all sides, and one of incredulity from Gentle. Trundling forward to fill the breadth of the gates was a 15-foot study in kitsch.
a sculpted representation of Saints Cries and Evendown, standing shoulder to shoulder, their arms stretched out towards the yearning crowd, while their eyes rolled in their carved sockets like those of carnival dummies, looking down on their flock as if affrighted by them one moment and up to heaven the next. But it was their apparel that drew Gentle's appalled gaze. They were clothed in their largesse, dressed in food from throat to foot. Coats of meat still smoking from the ovens covered their torsos. Sausages hung in steaming loops around their necks and wrists. At their groins hung sacks heavy with bread, while the layers of their skirts were of fruit and fish. The crowd instantly surged forward to denude them, the brawlers merciless in their hunger, beating each other as they climbed for their share. The saints were not without defence, however. There were penalties for the gluttonous. Hooks and spikes, expressly designed to wound, were set among the bountiful folds of skirts and coats. The devotees seemed not to care, but climbed up over the statues, disdainful of fruit and fish, in order to reach the steaks and sausages above. Some fell, doing themselves bloody mischief on the way down. Others, scrambling over the victims, reached their goals with shrieks of glee, and set about loading the bags on their backs. Even then, in their triumph, they were not secure. Those behind either dragged them from their perches, or pulled the bags from their backs and pitched them to accomplices in the crowd, where they in turn were set upon and robbed. Nicodemus held on to Gentle's belt so that they wouldn't be separated in this melee, and after much manoeuvring they reached the base of the statues. The machine had been designed to block the gates, but Nicodemus now squatted down in front of the plinth, and, her activities concealed from the guards watching from above the gate, tore at the casing that housed the vehicle's wheels. It was beaten metal, but it came away like cardboard beneath her assault, its rivets flying. Then she ducked into the gap she'd created. Gentle followed. Once below the saints, the din of the crowd became remoter, the thump of bodies punctuating the general hubbub. It was almost completely dark, but they shimmered forward on their stomachs, the engine, huge and hot, dripping its fluids on them as they went. As they reached the other side, and Nicodemus began to prise away the casing there, the sound of shouting became louder. Gentle looked around. Others had discovered Nicodemus's handiwork, and, perhaps thinking there were new treasures to be discovered beneath the idols, were following. Not two or three now, but many. Gentle began to lend Nicodemus a hand as the space filled up with bodies, new brawls erupting as the pursuers fought for access. The whole structure, enormous as it was, began to shudder, the combination of brawlers below and above conspiring to tip it. With the violence of the rocking increasing by the moment, Gentle had sight of escape. A sizable courtyard lay on the other side of the saints, scored by the tracks of the engine and littered with discarded food. The instability of the machine had not gone unnoticed, and two guards were presently forsaking their meal of prime steak and raising the alarm with panicked shouts. Their retreat allowed Nicodemus to wriggle free unnoticed, then turn to haul Gentle after her. The juggernaut was now close to toppling, and shots were being fired on the other side as the guards above the gate sought to dissuade the crowd from further burrowings. Gentle felt hands grasping at his legs, but he kicked back at them as Nicodemus dragged him forward and slid out into the open air as several cracks, like sudden thunder, announced that the saints were tired of teetering and ready to fall. Backs bent, Gentle and Nicodemus darted across the rind and crust-littered ground to the safety of the shadows as, with a great din, the saints fell backwards like comic drunkards, a mass of their adherents still clinging to arms and coats and skirts. The structure came apart as it hit the ground, pitching pieces of carved, cooked and crippled flesh in all directions. The guards were descending from the ramparts now to stem with bullets the flow of the crowd. Gentle and Nicodemus didn't linger to watch this fresh horror, but took to their heels up and away from the gates, the pleas and howls of those maimed by the fall, following them through the darkness.
2. What's the din, Rosengarten?
There's a minor problem at the Gate of Saints, sir.
Are we under siege?
No, it was merely an unfortunate accident.
Fatalities?
Nothing significant. The gate's now been sealed.
And Quasar? How's she?
I haven't spoken with Sadox since early evening.
Then find out.
Of course.
Rosengarten withdrew, and the autarch returned his attention to the man transfixed in the chair close by.
These Isordorexian knights, he said to the fellow, they're so very long. In the fifth, you know, they're half this length, and I used to complain they were over too soon. But now, he sighed, now I wonder if I wouldn't be better off going back there and founding a new Isordorex. What do you think?
The man in the chair didn't reply. His cries had long since ceased, though the reverberations, more precious than the sound itself and more tantalizing, continued to shake the air, even to the ceiling of this chamber, where clouds sometimes formed and shed delicate, cleansing rains. The autarch drew his own chair up closer to the man. A sack of living fluid, the size of his head, was clamped to the victim's chest, its limbs fine as thread, puncturing him and reaching into his body to touch his heart, lungs, liver and lights. He'd summoned the entity which was the shreds of a once much more fabulous beast, the Renunciance, from the inn over, selecting it as a surgeon might choose some instrument from a tray, to perform a delicate and very particular task. Whatever the nature of such summoned beasts, he had no fear of them. Decades of such rituals had familiarized him with every species that haunted the inn over, and while there were certainly some he would never have dared bring into the living world, most had enough base instinct to know their master's voice and would obey him within the confines of their wit. This creature he'd called Abelove, after a lawyer he'd known briefly in the fifth, who'd been as leech-like as this scrap of malice and almost as foul-smelling.
How does it feel?
The autarch asked, straining to catch the merest murmur of a reply.
The pain's past, hasn't it?
Didn't I say it would? The man's eyes flickered open and he licked his lips. They made something very close to a smile.
You feel a kind of union with Abelove, am I right? It's worked its way into every little part.
Please speak,
or I'll take it from you.
You'll bleed from every hole it's made, but that pain won't be anything beside the loss you'll feel.
Don't, the man said. Then talk to me, the autarch replied, all reason. Do you know how difficult it is to find a leech like this? They're almost extinct, but I gave this one to you, didn't I? And all I'm asking is that you tell me how it feels.
It feels good.
Is that Abelove talking, or you?
We're the same,
came the reply.
Like sex, is it?
No.
Like love, then?
No. Like I'm unborn again.
In the womb?
In the womb.
Oh, God, how I envy you. I don't have that memory. I never floated in a mother.
The autarch rose from his chair, his hand covering his mouth. It was always like this when the dregs of Crouchy moved in his veins. He became unbearably tender at such times, moved to expressions of grief and rage at the obscurest cue.
To be joined with another soul, he said, indivisibly, consumed and made whole in the same moment. What a precious joy.
He turned back to his prisoner, whose eyes were closing again. The autarch didn't notice.
It's times like this, he said, I wish I were a poet. I wish I had the words to express my yearning. I think that if I knew that one day, I don't care how many years from now, centuries even, I don't care, if I knew that one day I was going to be united indivisibly with another soul, I could begin to be a good man.
He sat down again beside the captive, whose eyes were completely closed.
But it won't happen, he said, tears beginning to come. We're too much ourselves, afraid of letting go of what we are in case we're nothing, and holding on so tight we lose everything else.
Agitation was shaking the tears out of his eyes now.
Are you listening to me? He said.
He shook the man whose mouth fell open, a trickle of saliva dribbling from one corner.
Listen, he raged. I'm giving you my pain here.
Receiving no response, he stood up and struck his captive across the face so hard the man toppled over, the chair to which he was bound falling with him, the creature clamped to his chest, convulsed in sympathy with its host.
I didn't bring you here to sleep,
the autarch said. I want you to share your pain with me. He put his hands on the leech and began to tear it from the man's chest. The creature's panic flooded its host, and instantly the man began to writhe, the cords drawing blood as he fought to keep the leech from being stolen. Less than an hour before, when Abe Love had been brought out of the shadows and displayed to the prisoner, he'd begged to be spared its touch. Now, finding his tongue again, he pleaded twice as hard not to be separated from it, his pleas swooping into screams when the parasite's filaments, barbed so as to prevent their removal, were wrenched from the organs they'd pierced. As soon as they broke surface, they began to flail wildly, seeking to return to their host or find a new one. But the autarch was unmoved by the panic of either lover, and divided them like death itself, pitching Abe Love across the chamber and taking the man's face in fingers sticky with his infatuate's blood. "Now," he said, "how does it feel?"
"Give it back, please, give it back."
"Is this like being born?" the autarch said.
"Whatever you say, yes, yes, just give it back."
The autarch left the man's side and crossed the chamber to the spot where he'd made the summoning. He picked his way through the spirals of human gut he'd arranged on the floor as bait, and snatched up the knife still lying in the blood beside the blindfolded head, returning at no more than an amble to where the victim was lying. There he cut the prisoner's bonds and stood back to watch the rest of the show. Though he was grievously wounded, his punctured lungs barely able to draw breath, the man fixed his eyes on the object of his desire and began to crawl towards it. Ashen, the autarch let him crawl, knowing as he went that the distance was too great and the scene must end in tragedy. The lover had advanced no more than a couple of yards when there was a rapping on the door. "Go away," the autarch said, but the rapping came again, this time accompanied by Rosengarten's voice.
"Quasar's gone, sir," he said.
The autarch watched the crawling man's despair and despaired himself. Despite all his indulgences, the woman had deserted him for the man of sorrows.
"Come in," he called.
Rosengarten entered and made his report. Sadox was dead, stabbed and thrown from a window. Quasar's quarters were empty, her servant vanished, her dressing room overturned. A search for her abductors was already underway.
"Abductors?" the autarch said. "No, Rosengarten, there are no abductors. She's gone of her own accord."
Not once as he spoke did he take his eyes off the lover, who had covered a third of the distance between his chair and his darling, but was weakening fast.
"It's over," the autarch said. "She's gone to find her redeemer, the poor bitch."
"Then shouldn't I dispatch troops to find her?" Rosengarten said. "The city's dangerous."
"So's she when she wants to be.
The women in the bastion taught her some unholy stuff."
"I hope that cesspit's been burnt to the ground," Rosengarten said with a rare passion.
"I doubt it is," the autarch replied. "They got ways of protecting themselves."
"Not from me they haven't," Rosengarten boasted.
"Yes, even from you," the autarch told him. "Even from me. The power of women can't be scoured away, however hard we try. The Unbeheld attempted it, but he didn't succeed. There's always some corner."
"Just say the word," the commander broke in, "and I'll go down there now. Hang the bitches in the streets."
"No, you don't understand," the autarch said, his voice almost monotonous, but all the more sorrowful for that. "The corner isn't out there, it's in here." He pointed to his skull. "It's in our minds. Their mysteries obsess us, even though we put them out of sight. Even me. God knows I should be.